Thanks. So at the EMEA Union that I just got back from, I had signed up for a class that Rav Yoel Ben-Nun, who was a dear teacher and friend, and we've known each other for 40 years now, was participating in. I guess that's probably the best way to say it, because normally when you hear a name associated with a class, you think that's the lecturer. And Rav Ben-Nun gives a few lectures every year at the Meiyun. There was also several other people involved in this, because it was a pedagogy session that part of it was to use different technological tools and show how they could be used to enhance the classroom experience. And some of it was for differentiated learning. Some of it was just sort of not tricks exactly, but sort of cute little devices to keep people's attention. So as an example, just something to share, as an example, when you first got to the class, everybody who was enrolled in the class had gotten a link. Most of them opened up on their phone, a few of us opened up on their computers, a link, and you were immediately into the class. And one of the first things that happened was that, okay, Aseret HaDibrot, and explained why they were using Aseret HaDibrot, the 10 utterances, as the focal point of the class. What do you think is the key phrase in Aseret HaDibrot? And you wrote it in. And in the meantime, on the board, what was really, really cool was immediately the word lo came up really big, and then anochi came up kind of a little smaller, and then kabed was there for some reason, I'm not sure. Zachor was there. Hashem Elokecha, certain phrases that people thought were the most key things. And what you were watching in front of you, I mean, we've all seen this, but what you're watching in front of you was the group that you're sitting with,
like the word cloud.
and it's what they call it?
Word
A
cloud.
word cloud. Cloud?
Word cloud.
Right. So it, and what you're seeing now is, first of all, there's certainly a subtle pressure to participate. I mean, I put my name right away. I happen to know that Rav Ben-Nun was moving towards the word low, and so I cheated a little bit, right? But it was really interesting to see what ailed the people, and when you see it, you also try to think, why did they think that? Like, what's the thing behind it? It was really fascinating. And then Rav Ben-Nun got up and actually taught the Aseret HaDibrot, but he showed a certain pedagogic model, which is very interesting, and that's what I wanted to share with you. And then there were further talks about different devices that you could use to enhance this and all. The reason I picked this was both because I knew I'd be getting right off the plane from the Meiyun and coming to give the shiur, and with all of that excitement and exhaustion, but also because, of course, this week is Parshat Vetchanan, and it's in the Parsha. However, I wanted to be true to the shiur, and the text that Rav Ben-Nun used was the text that we have in Yitro, which is different than the text in Vetchanan. Part of what he did, although he didn't teach us frontally, part of what his handout was actually the comparison. We did that, I think, last year, the comparison between the two versions that he wrote and how he explained that. But I want to do this just within what we have here, and the Aseret HaDibrot. So the Aseret HaDibrot, the 10 utterances, which, as we all know, is commonly translated as the Ten Commandments, and we all know that Ten Commandments is a really poor translation because the word Dibrot doesn't mean that. The Torah never calls these things Aseret HaDibrot. It does call it Aseret HaDvarim in several places, including in Vetchanan and in Kitisa. And a davar, or diber, as to use the singular that Yirmiyahu adopts, it means an utterance, as a statement, which is why the Greek word is dekalogos. Dekalogos, the 10 logos, words. And how it become Ten Commandments, unclear, but it's also because people, I don't think, have a really clear idea of what a commandment is. If you go through the Aseret HaDibrot, how many actually mitzvot are there in that group? Because we all agree what the boundaries are. It starts with Anochi and ends with Asher L'Re'acha, in both versions. And so how many mitzvot are there? If you just think about the Yitro, because the throwing of Etchanan in adds at least one, if not two others. But just the Yitro, how many mitzvot do you think there are?
I'm going to guess nine.
Okay, so you would come up with 14 or 15, all right? Now, I'll show them to you right now because you have the text in front of you on the first page. We're also doing something very unusual for here because, as you know, I'm always careful to have everything be on one single page back to back. But because of the nature of what we're doing, I asked Elliot, and he's always just really helpful and charming about this, to Xerox it the way that we have it. You have the entire text in front of you on the upper side, then again repeated on the lower side, just broken out a little differently. We'll talk about the breakup. But Anochi Adonai Elohecha Asher Hoceiticha Me'eretz Beit Avadim. That, according to many, is the first of the Dibrot. Certainly, according to synagogue art, it is, because the Anochi, I am the Lord your God. And if you look at synagogue art throughout the picture of the tablets, there's either an Aleph or Anochi Hashem, depending how detailed it gets, in slot number one. According to almost all Rishonim, that's a mitzvah. And what's that mitzvah? Mitzvah to believe in God or to know there's a God. A little unclear in the Rambam's wording. Rav Vanel disagrees and maintains that it's not a mitzvah, but it's really the premise of everything. But according to almost everybody else, it's a mitzvah. We'll count that as one.
The Christians don't count that as one.
The Christians don't have a counting. They're not concerned with that. Now, lo yelecha Elohim acharim al panai, which means you shall not have any other gods. What does it mean to have gods? It means to believe in them. This is a what?
Polytheism.
Well, but doing what? What's the specific act? Because remember, when we talk about mitzvot, we're talking about something very specific that you can point to and say, you've done this, you violated the law, you've done this, you fulfilled the law, you failed to do this, you failed to fulfill the law, you didn't do it this way, you skirted the violation, something like that. Right? So we have to define it. What is lo yelachai Elohim acharim al panai?
Don't believe in them.
Don't believe in them. Don't hold them to be gods, other gods. And now, lo tasel chafesa v'chol tuna asher b'shamayim ma'o asher b'shamayim tzutach v'shamayim mitachat la'aretz. What does that mean?
Fashioning.
Don't actually make, which means, by the way, even making for hire. Right? I don't believe in this stuff. But somebody paid me some money, I'm going to make an idol, image of something in the heavens, on the earth, something below the earth, and in the water. Can't do that. So that's how many mitzvot already.
Two or three.
You've got three. Anochi, lo yelecha, and lo taselecha. Lo tishtachave lahem. What does that mean?
Don't bow
to them. Which means even if somebody else made it, and even if you did not accept it as a god, meaning you didn't do the other thing, lo yelecha, we're bowing down to it. And now this looks a little tricky, but velo ta'ovdem, which means? Don't serve them. Now, what's the difference between lo tishtachave lahem velo ta'ovdem? So the way Chazal develop it is that Lo Tishtachav Elohim becomes a model for four types of worship that are unique to God, and therefore if you do them for any other God, even if it's not their kind of worship, you're in violation. And that's Ishtachavah, Haktaraz, Vicha, and Zrikat Adam, I think. And then Lo Tovdeim means not to worship them in any way which is not one of those things,
but their
way. So the classic example Chazal talk about is putting a stone at the feet of, or in the arms of Mercules, which may or may not be Mercury, I'm not clear what it is, but, you know, some sort of worship that we would never do for God.
I thought you were going to go to Balpar, that's much more.
Yeah, I want to stay with me. So, especially when it's at lunchtime. So, Velota of Dame. So, how many mitzvot do we have so far? Five. Okay? You're shaking your head because?
I'm enjoying the
chair. Oh, okay, I thought it was because you're disagreeing. Okay, good. All right.
He was shaking in approval.
Ki Anochi. Now notice.
This when you're talking.
Okay. So ki Anochi. So what does that mean? Ki Anochi.
It's a reason.
So it's a reason for this prohibition or these prohibitions. Adonai Elohecha Elkanah Poked Avon Avot Abanim Al Shelishim Val Reim Sonai Sechez Alafim Avayu Shomrei Mitzvotai. I reward those who love me and I punish those who go against what I say. All right. So far five. Lo Tisa Shem Adonai Elohecha Lashav, which means. Sort of, but let's be a little bit tighter. Lo tisa implies using it in an oath. Chazal learned as a derivative of this the idea of motzi shem shemayim mevatala, using God's name with absolutely no purpose. Not like in learning or something like that, but just, you know. However, that's a subsidiary which very likely is derabbanan. The real issue right here is taking an oath and using God's name either in a shuat shav, a vain oath, like if I take an oath that I'm going to swear and I use God's name like that, that I saw a building flying upside down, you know, singing Kriyat Shema in Arabic, right? That's, you know, that's something that's silly, and we all know it's silly.
The explanation that I like there, about the Blach say, was that you don't go and blow up a building and kill 3,000 people, and you do it in God's name.
Right, but that's not the halachic issue here. Correct. There's lots of Chomer LaDrush on 9/11.
Do we understand the saying, like, to translate also to English? Like, you can't say, I swear to, like, you can't say, like...
Right, so we try to avoid doing that, even though, in a purely halachic sense, you saying it that way is clearly just a colloquial way of trying to say, I really mean it, and you're not really formally issuing an oath, but it's really a bad idea. That's a good idea for someone to stay away from. You know what? Something else, and this is something we talked about years ago in the Beit Midrash. If your word isn't trusted enough that you need to always invoke God to make people believe you, you got a different problem. Your word should be good enough. You shouldn't have to say, I swear it, or I'm like that. You should be able to say, this is what I'm doing, or this is what I saw.
Isn't that a standard Shavuot based in?
Sure, but that's when there is a challenge to your belief because someone else is challenging you. Someone says, I gave you an item, and I think you absconded with it, and you're saying that it got stolen, and I don't believe you. So then the Shua, which the Torah institutes, is there to back up your credibility. But if in normal human conversation, you're not trusted enough to say something that you have to back it up, with words like that, then there's another problem that you have with your own trust.
Secular court feels you have to back it up.
What?
Secular court feels you have to back it up.
Yeah, interesting. We don't issue a shvuah to Aiden, right? We start with the assumption Aiden we're going to be telling the truth.
No, I meant the court of law.
I know. Who do they issue the thing to? To witnesses. Saying
Bible.
We don't.
Your hand on the Bible.
But we don't. We don't do that to witnesses. We have the defendant has to in some circumstances, and occasionally plaintiff. All right, good. So far we've got six mitzvot. Now, Zachor Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho. Is that a mitzvah?
Everyone.
Certainly it is. And what's the halachic application of this mitzvah? Like, how do you fulfill this mitzvah?
Well, this is Zachor, the Shamar. So
that's what I'm saying, just staying within Yitro, Zachor. So what is it that we do to fulfill that? Say,
Kiddush.
Oh, now I did Zachor.
So Kiddush
is the way the Rambam says it very simply, and it seems to be from the Sugya in Arvei Pesachim that Zachor is about Kiddush. The Ramban extends it in an interesting way. He says that every time you refer to a day of the week as a day around Shabbat, you're fulfilling Zechirat Shabbat. It's the Ramban in the beginning of Perek Yudbet. What? And so the Ramban, right, so that's when we say Shir Shoyom, so that's why, for instance, our family minhag is to say the Shir Shoyom with Vilna Gaon, right? Which means it's not necessarily Sunday Shir. This year Shavuot was on a Sunday. We said Yud Tet, even though that's not the Sunday Shir. But I always started by saying Hayom Yom Rishon to Shabbat, and then I would say the special Shir because I want to fulfill that mitzvah of Zechirat Shabbat every day of the week to remember that Shabbat. Okay, so that's now seven mitzvot. Shesh Nevim Tavod Vasita Kol Malachtecha V'Yom HaShviyi Shabbat La'Adonai Elohecha. What's that statement? Is that a mitzvah? No. But it's a setup of the mitzvah. I'm going to show you how that's different than Ki Anochi Adonai Elohecha El Kana or Ki Lo Yinakeh. Now, Uvayom HaShviyi Shabbat La'Adonai Elohecha Lo Ta'asecho Malacha Atav Incha V'Tach V'Avdecha M'Avdecha, etc. Which means that's a mitzvah. Now we got to seven. Right? Ki Sheish Nevim, and now that's explaining the reason for it. Kaver Tavicha V'Timecha. What's that? It's a mitzvah. How do you fulfill Kibbutz Av Em? All right. So the answer is the best answer you can ever give to any question you ever asked, which is, it depends. It's always really a golden answer. Right? How do you fulfill Kibbutz Av Em?
It depends.
Right. Exactly. So how do you fulfill Kibbutz Av Em?
Well, there's all kinds of things you can do.
You, Sam Smith, how do you fulfill Kibbutz Av Em?
By growing up in that way.
No, now. Right now.
Right now? At
yeah.
The moment?
Yeah, this in your life right now. How do I do Kibbutz Av Em? My parents are gone.
Yeah.
So I yahrzeit. Right? I give a shiur in my father's memory. Right? I go and visit my parents' graves. I do things to honor their memory. What about when I was a teenager and they were alive and healthy? How do you do Kibbutz Av Em? It depends on what the need is. Depends on what the need is.
Yeah. Don't interrupt them.
Right? So that's mora. That's a different one, which is fear and awe. Kibud is the positive aspect. So my father says, I need some water. I go and get the water.
Right.
My mom says, can you go pick up stuff at the grocery store? I go and pick up stuff at the grocery store. Right? So doing things that they request. And there's lots of details about it and how it goes. And it changes dramatically from when you are a kid and your parents are healthy and working, etc., to when you're an adult and your parents are starting to get older, to the point where you are an older adult and your parents are perhaps infirm, and then, you know, it shifts. Okay, but keep it up, man. Good.
What's that?
That's something new. It's an instrumentation
of
the Torah.
Yeah.
Like, it's not instrumentality.
Right. In other words, it's like not the reason for it, but the consequence of it, but it's certainly not part of the mitzvah. Okay. Good. So far, how many mitzvot do we have?
Eight.
Okay, good. Lo tirtzach. That's easy. Okay. Lo tinaf. Okay. Lo tignov, which is halachically understood to refer to what?
Kidnapping.
Because?
Capital punishment.
Because, right, exactly. Davar olami minyano, it's context. All the other mitzvot here include capital punishment, and therefore the only kind of theft that can involve capital punishment is kidnapping. And that's why in Unklus, for instance, they say lo tignov in parentheses, because in some version of Unklus says nefash, don't steal a person.
What is the violation of stealing, period?
That's in Lotigzol and Lotignovu, which is elsewhere in the Torah, like in Kedoshim, right? And implied in the end of Parshat Vayikra with the Asham and Gzelo.
You know, you said that they're all capital punishment. The first two, it would seem to me, have no punishment at all because they just go to mental states. So baiting can punish you based on the mitzvah.
Exactly. So the way that...
Not everything is chayv mitzvah. Lo sachmo is not chayv mitzvah.
Which is... Yeah, we're going to talk about that. Exactly. I'll talk about that right now. But to answer your question, David, about the first two, the way that it's sort of developed a little bit later is that every one of them is something that has within its purview the potential for capital punishment. So Avodah Zarah certainly does. They don't touch Anochi because, again, I think Anochi, we're going to talk about this, Anochi secretly, I think most people feel really... It's a little hard to count it in the group because of the way that it's presented. And questions whether you can even consider that a mitzvah. But again, most of you shown him in the Moneh mitzvot, and those who count mitzvot do count. Okay, lo tanev rechayit shaker, which means? All right, so how do you violate this? What do you do to violate this? So testify in court falsely against to somebody's disinterest.
But wouldn't we have to understand it to be their death? Just like going based off what, no. So we also have to understand that Lo Tachmon is only testifying against them getting killed.
No, Lo Tanev Rechayit Shaker means any violation. But however, it includes the potential for a death penalty because
because
in what case would you be death? If it's Einim Zomim and you testify, you colluded with somebody else to testify that somebody else had done something that should get them the death penalty, you could be killed. So theoretically, false testimony has within it the potential for being a capital crime.
Why don't we apply that same logic to Lotignov and say Lotignov is just general stealing?
Because Chazal understood stealing items and kidnapping as two different categories, whereas they looked at testimony as being sort of a spectrum, right? That's a very good question. The reason seems to be because the Torah itself refers to Gonev Nefesh Me'acham V'Tamer Bo Macharo. You know, it speaks about kidnapping, and even though it uses the word gonev, it just deals with it in such a different way. And that, of course, may be a partial critique on Yosef's brothers. Gonev ish me'achav, using that word. So, by the way, what happens if I just lie? Just lie. Like, let's say that I was to tell you right now that I got in yesterday from Israel instead of today. I didn't want you to feel bad about me coming straight here. What happens if, let's say I happen to know that there are guys here who are going to feel like, I can't believe he came to give a share, he just got off the plane. I don't want you to think, because I said, I got in Monday. Right? It was a lie. Am I violating anything?
I mean,
I'm violating anything.
Midvar Sheker Tirchak.
And where does Midvar Sheker Tirchak apply? Also in court. Meaning that you go to your grandmother's house and your grandmother makes a cake that could kill an army. And you eat some of the cake and you somehow, like, survive. And your grandmother says, so how was the cake? There was no mitzvah in the world to tell her it almost killed me. And to say the cake was delicious is totally fine. And in some cases, maybe even the right thing to do, not just okay.
Well, isn't there
right?
That thing about on a wedding with the bride?
Oh, good, very good.
I mean, I know there's a machlokes.
So there's two things. One thing is what Benny mentions is the sugya at the beginning of the second parak of Tubot, the machlokes b'chum b'et Hillel, about what you sing in front of the bride, and we pass on b'et Hillel kalana b'chasuda. That may be something else, though, because there, the reality is that beauty is subjective, and the fact that you're dancing in front of the girl and you don't find her to be that, well, that's fine. You didn't marry her. He did. So hopefully he married her, right? But the other example is the famous Gemara in Yevamot, where say, Mutar l'shalom b'nei shalom, you're allowed a life for peace. And the example given is when the three visitors come to Avraham, and Sarah laughs and says, how could I have kids? I'm past menopause, and my man is old. And they say to Avram, why is she saying, how could I have kids? I'm too old. And they leave out the part that Adoni Zaken. And there's several other examples where it's clear that God promotes a cover-up of sorts in order to create domestic harmony or to save your life. Shmuel goes to Beit Lechem to anoint a new king. He says to God, how can I go? Shaul's going to kill me. And God says, okay, here's a cover story. Bring an animal and tell him you're coming to do a korban. And while you're doing it, you'll anoint the one I'll tell you. So in other words, God is mandating that. Besides all the stories in Bereshit with subterfuge and everything else.
Why is it when they fight a battle and they capture the prisoners, why is that not kidnapping in a sense?
Because that's not called kidnapping. What's kidnapping?
Kidnapping somebody.
That's not kidnapping. That's not called kidnapping. That's like they're saying, if you shoot somebody in battle, how come it's not murder? It's not murder. The rules of war are different, right? What's the prohibition of kidnapping? It's essentially about slavery. That's really what it's about. You take somebody, and you then hit amer ba'umacharo. You're selling him as a slave. This is what people would do. Marauders would come in, like Amalekim, and they would come and they would grab all these people who were innocent, weren't warriors, weren't involved in them, they weren't soldiers, and they just grab them because they're able to come in and grab them, and then they take them to the slave market. That's the prohibition here. Right? The rules of war are very different.
Well, even
the Eshi Yifat Torah is a good counterexample. The rules of war are different also because the Torah recognizes that in wartime things are going to play out differently. Bill's still waiting for why I was excited about this very much. So you'll find out. All right. Lo tachmod beit re'acha. Lo tachmod beit re'acha, which means? Now, this is very difficult because, of course, coveting is something that, A, you might not be able to control, and B, there's no way to regulate it or to enforce it. All right? And very difficult mitzvah. The way the Rambam reads it is that you only are in active violation of the law when you act on it. By the way, lo tachmod doesn't mean that you go to your neighbor's house and you see that they have a really cool jaguar and you say, I want one like that. That's not lo tachmod, that's just good taste. What lo tachmod is, you go and you see your neighbor has this really cool jaguar and you say, I want his jaguar. And that jaguar. And part of it is not just because I like the jaguar, but I want to get it from him. And then you then collude and plot of different ways to get the jaguar from him. That's where you're actually in violation of lo tachmod, and that could involve, of course, a capital crime because look at the rest of it.
Acting on it.
Exactly. And acting, in a sense, successfully.
But what does bait mean? What is the bait?
So beit re'acha here actually seems to mean his house only because the next line, which is set off as a separate mitzvah, because lo tachmod again, which is why I said there could be 14 or 15 here, depending how we count, lo tachmod eshet re'acha. All right, which
so
of course is
the jaguar included as part of his house?
Just a second.
Okay.
Va'avada, va'avdo, va'amato, v'sharo, v'chamaro, which is now looks like the broad thing of possessions. And then v'chol asher l'reyacha includes the jaguar.
Why doesn't you just say v'chol asher l'reyacha?
What?
Why doesn't you say v'chol asher l'reyacha?
Yeah, good question. So why are Evan, Amma, Shor, and Chamor included?
So
it could be that they're saying that includes even living things. It includes, perhaps a range of different kinds of animals, etc., both tamei, tahor, right? Okay, so that's the scope. So as we saw, there's certainly well over 10, at the very least 13, and at the very most 15 probably mitzvot. And then, like Ari pointed out, in Dvarim, we have a whole other word in there, shamor yom ha-shabbat, which is a separate mitzvah, although it may be the same as lo tasa kol melacha, because it's a way of speaking about the lo tasas. All right. Now, what you see on top of page 1 is the classic way that the 10 statements have been divided. After all, if there's 10 statements, they're divided. What's curious about this division is two things. One is, if you look at, and I numbered them, if you look at number 1, again, number 1, which we said may not even be a mitzvah, but it's a diber, in a Sefer Torah, number 1 is not set off separately from number 2. In other words, When you look at a Sefer Torah, it reads Anochi Adonai Elohecha Shetzivcha Me'eretz Yisrael Be'etavadim Lo Yelecha in one line, and then you continue. There's no parsha break. The first parsha break is after Mitzvotai at the end of number two. That's problem number one. The opposite side of problem number one is look at number 10. You see number 10? The Torah does say, Lo tachmod beit re'acha, break. Lo tachmod eshet re'acha. So what we do is thematically, we say there's 10 dibrot. Anochi is a separate one, and Lo yelecha is a separate one. And by the way, everybody in the world talks about the fourth commandment being Shabbat, the fifth commandment, the sixth commandment. I think that some guy even wrote a series of crime novels, which he talked about the seventh commandment and the eighth commandment, you know, people violating these things. And everybody, the whole world, everybody talks about, you know, the tenth commandment, right, the coveting. And this, again, is how it's represented in synagogue art. Question is this the most accurate representation? So if you look below it, you'll see a different way of dividing it up. That we start with Lo Yelecha, which is the first thing that's actually telling you to do something. And Anochi should have been included in that line. I mistakenly took it. It dropped out. But it should say Anochi, Anochi, Asher Tzeicha, Mitzvayim, Yevadim, Lo Yelecha, Yevichim, all of that in number one. So the first Dibar is essentially thematically about belief in God. Right? And number two then becomes about God's name. Number three becomes Shabbat. Number four becomes parents. Number five becomes murder, etc. And then coveting is, the way the Torah presents it, two separate things. Okay. Problem is, if you think about it, that's also a little unsatisfying. Coveting, which is the hardest thing to decipher, suddenly gets two mitzvot. It's a little bit odd. So Rabbi Nun suggested a different approach to this. I'm going to introduce it by looking at the psukim on page 2, and then I'll give a brief explanation. We'll go to page 3 to see sort of how he did it. But after page 2, I'll tell you what we did there, and then we'll look at page 3. Item number 1. Source number 1 is the preface to the covenant at Har Sinai. The covenant at Har Sinai is called a brit, right? And so therefore, we have to take a look at these statements as being a brit. How do I know they're a brit? Because what happens after God says these statements? What does God give Moshe as a souvenir of his visit to Har Sinai?
Ten Commandments.
Tablets with these statements on it. And what are those tablets called? Luchot Habrit. And what's the Aron called that keeps them? Aron Habrit. Because it's the Aron that carries the brit. So this is the brit. These statements are the brit. Okay, good. Now, this is not the only brit that we make. What other occasions do we have where, as a people, we make a brit with God?
Circumcision.
As a people, not individual. As a people, as a nation.
Korban Pesach.
Okay? So Korban Pesach may be confirming the brit, but actually making a brit. Right, that's as a people, I'm saying. Representative is an individual. Right?
Oh, so
let's brit have a song.
The 12th.
With Avram, with the piece of what?
When they cross the Arden.
Exactly. Yeah. All right? When we get to, when the first thing we're told to do when we come to land, it's not the first thing we do, but the first thing we're told to do when we come to land is to go to Har Gerizim and Har Eval. Right? And take a look at source 2. Eile yamdu levarech et ha'am al Har Gerizim be'ol rechem et ha'yardein, Shimon v'levi v'yudah v'sachar v'zoyzev v'nyamin. So who's going to stand on Har Gerizim, Har Bracha? Right? You guys know that it's Har Bracha. You know that there's a village there called Bracha, right next to the Samaritan village. And Ve'elim du'a kol ha'ayval, Ruven Gad ve'asher zvulun dan naftali. How many on each mountain? Six and six. Together the 12, all of Am Yisrael. And in the past, they've given a shir explaining why those six and why they're on those mountains.
Later was in the
mountain. Right.
No, he was there.
No. This is Har Gerizim and Har Eval, the covenant, Deuteronomy 27, and later at the end of Yoshua Chet, where it tells it that we actually did it. Mm-hmm. And it's a one-time thing in history, but the six tribes on each side facing each other, the Kohanim in the middle, and Levim saying Arur Ha'ish, Baruch Ha'ish, etc., and everybody saying Amen, but the tribes being up there.
What was the purpose?
A lot of possibilities, but it was certainly a brit. It was certainly a covenanting. As a matter of fact, there's some who've considered that Har Gerizim may be called Har Gerizim because it's a thing with Sikul Otiyot, where, you know, letter order sometimes switches in Hebrew, like Keves and Kesev, Simlat Salma. Har Gerizim is really from the word Gezerah, a place of a brit. Maybe. Yeah, I think it's far-fetched. But something's made, an idea has been made. Okay, let's move ahead in history. The Jewish people are exiled. We just had Tishah B'av. Koresh comes and makes his famous Hatzarah. Anybody who wants to go back can go back. Very small group comes back. And then later, about 70 years later, a fellow named Ezra Kohen comes back. And in Sefer Nehemiah, Perek Chet, we hear a story about Ezra getting up and having a big public reading of the Torah. He tells them about Rosh Hashanah that evidently they didn't know about, and they start really getting upset and crying, and he says, no, today's a happy day. Very nice. And then he tells them about Sukkot, which they never heard of evidently. They go out and they build Sukkot. Kakatuv. Ezra is recovenanting with them. Please take a look at this very strange thing. Vayamor Ezra sofer al migdal etz asher asu ladavar. There's a translation here. Vayamor etzlo mitya v'shema v'anayav v'uriya v'chlikya maseya al mino. On his right hand, there's six guys. V'mispalop, tayam mishayam malkiya v'chashum v'chavadina zachariya mishulam. Zachariya mishulam is his name. Which means, there's six guys on each side. All right? So, why is Ezra doing this? Ezra's standing up, one man, he's making a comment to the people, but he has six helpers on one side, six helpers, that's clearly ceremonial, it's not utilitarian. Okay.
There's seven on the left side.
Yeah, except Mishulam is actually, it's a bit translation. Mishulam is a nickname for Zachariah. The Mishulam Be'uvdei. If you take a look at it, the Kohen, Gadol, wears four special vestments that no other Kohen wears. What are they? So there's the tzitz and the meal we're familiar with, but what? The choshen? What does the choshen have on it?
12
all the names, plus a few other extra names, so every letter is possibly there. And then there's the ephod. What connects the ephod to the choshen? Kitvot ephod. And what's on kitvot ephod? And what's on the Avnei HaShoham? Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisrael, right? All 12 names, 6 and 6. All right, the machlok could be shown about what the direction is, but it's in birth order. Is it this or this? Okay, but all 6 and 6. Rabbeinu even points out that there are several things in the Mishkan that are considered to be constant. They have to be constantly there. What has to constantly be there?
The menorah.
There has to always be a ner. The ner has to be tamid. All right. What else? So there also has to be lachem panim. How does the Torah describe the lachem panim? What is it supposed to look like? I never thought of this. He says, v'lakachta sol at source 5, afito ta shteim esrei chalot. How many loaves?
12.
Right? Shnei esurim yachal achat. V'samta otam shteim arachot sheshem arachat. Meaning, there's two frames, and each one has 6 on them. 6 versus 6. And they're called lachem ha panim. Right? They're showbread. Okay. If you look at the story in the story of Eliyahu, Eliyahu's most famous moment was his victory on Har Chorev, on Har Carmel. He gets up to Har Carmel, and after all the Nevi'ah Baal do all their crazy stuff, Eliyahu gets ready. Okay, we got that silliness is done. Now let's get real. And what does he do? He first builds a ta'ala of water to try to demonstrate the miracle of the fire coming down, and he surrounds it with 12 stones. Why 12 stones? Kachel is 12 avanim. K'misparshiv tevnei Yaakov. So every time that there's a ma'amad habrit, every time that there's some sort of a presentation of a brit and creates some brit, it's always, the number is always 12 and it's 6 facing 6. Okay. Last thing to do before taking a look at page 3. Good. Is I've heard Rav Yol say this a number of times. I think it's also backed up by a lot of anthropological support and a lot of ancient Near Eastern texts. In the ancient world, very little was written down. Very little was written down. In the biblical period and pre-biblical period, we're talking about the second millennium BCE, very little was written down. Most of what we found, by the way, of writing is contracts. Most of the things we found are contracts or receipts. I don't find religious texts that often. How were religious norms, religious stories, epics, how were they transmitted?
Orally.
Chorally. The choir. There'd be a choir that would sing, and you think about it.
Makes you happy.
When you memorize a poem, which we all had to do at different times, some of us, not yet, had to do at different times, it's very difficult. But think about all the songs we grew up with.
Easy.
In whatever era. It's very easy. Why?
Because music is more memorable, easily memorable.
Right? So I can sing half the Carole King songs that are on Tapestry in a heartbeat without missing any words because the tune. Right? It's up there.
So
Beatles songs. Don't test me right now. All right.
No. But this raises a really significant question, and that is why all of the music of the Levium in the temple is not remembered, but texts are remembered.
Okay.
When music is easy to remember.
All right. Good. Good question. I don't have an answer for it. Right?
Nobody has an answer for it.
Okay. I don't have an answer.
It's a disturbing question.
Okay. However, Rav Yoel, therefore, maintains that the original way that information was not only transmitted but was declared was chorally. Chorally might not necessarily have meant musically. It could be a group of people standing and reciting it. Please turn to page 3. And before the session, they sent out an email to everybody in the session. There's about 100 people in the session, maybe only 50. I asked them for volunteers to be in the choir. So I immediately signed up. And the 12 of us showed up. The 12 people picked for the choir. So I showed up 10 minutes before the session. This is something unheard of in the Mayun. We don't do stuff like the Mayun is very formal and lectures and everything else. So we showed up 10 minutes early, and 12 of us, and we lined up, and we were each given one side to be on. I got to be on the bigger side. It was fun. And then when Rabbi Nun got up, and I'm just going to describe it for you. And I think that it was videotaped. You could probably see it. It's actually very cool to watch, but I'll describe it for you. He got up and explained what he was doing and explained the purpose of the presentation. And he then said as follows. You have this one structure, which is the synagogue art thing, that really kind of is unsatisfying. You have this other structure that we have, which is the one that we divided up a little differently. But it's, again, strange because Anochi isn't really part of it, and Lo Tachmod gets two. Is that the real structure? So he claims this is the real structure, what you have on the third page. And did a lot of work on the color. But what he did was he got up in the middle, six on each side, in the middle, like Ezra. And he declared what he called the Chelek HaEmuni, the doctrinal or theological components that were here. And then what happened was we were on the first side, so we declared Lo Yelecha. So here's what happened. Rabbi Nun gets up and says, Anochi Adonai Elohecha asher hotzeticha me'eretz Mitzrayim beit avadim. That's a declaration of faith. And I put those in green. We then said, the six of us said, Lo Yelecha Elohim achrim al panai. And this is really powerful when it and people did it right away. The whole room repeated after us. And he claimed this is what the real meaning of Shnayim Mikra v'chatargum is. What's Shnayim Mikra? It's call and response. Interesting thing. He does that. He gives a shiur, by the way, every Shabbat in Alon Shvut on Parshas. We're out there. And it's Shnayim Mikra. And the way he does it, he reads the Pasuk, everybody reads back, and then he teaches it. It's Shnayim Mikra. So we said, Lo yelecha v'im machirim al panai, and then I all repeated it. Then we said, Lo tazal hafesa v'chol tumana asher v'shvayim ma'ol. I made it smaller just to fit in the line. That's all command. They repeated it. We said, Lo tishtach avelahem. They repeated it. We said, Lo to'ovdeim. They repeated it. Then Rav Yoel said, Ki anochi adonai lecha al kana poker avon avot abanim, sheshim rabbeim mitzonai vosachez lavim avai yishomer mitzvotai. Because that is an emuni statement. That's not a directive. And David, what he was doing was collapsing both reason and consequence into that category. Then we said, Lo tisat shem adonai lecha lashav. And everybody answered. Then he said, Ki lo yinake adonai tasher yisat shem lashav. And then, interestingly enough, and this is what kind of jarred me a little bit, because I'm always used to, you know, counting the mitzvot, and there's two mitzvot asay and the rest. And he continued, Zachor et yom ha-shavad l'kadsho, shetun tavon v'asit l'kom l'atecha, yom ha-shavi shavad l'adonai v'acha. Because as far as he's concerned, what the main word in this entire thing is lo. And then what do we said? We said, lo tasecho malacha, ata v'incha v'itacha v'dacha v'incha v'incha v'gercha asher b'sharecha, which is the entire mitzvah. They repeated it, and then he read the rest, including Kabbalah Vicha Etimecha. As far as he's concerned, it's all part of the Emuni side.
Okay, that's very.
Go ahead.
It's forced. It's very forced. These are commands.
Right.
Word
so he,
of zachar, kabeh. These are
exactly. And he's not denying
verbs.
That they're did not deny that they're mitzvot, but he's saying the structure of the brit was that there are lotases and lotases, that the lotases on one side, and this is a critical difference. It's really mind-opening on this level. The mitzvot on one side are all couched in faith statements, which give a reason for them, a religious consequence to them, something about your life. So critically, we finished with that half, and then the other guys said, lo tirtzach. And it was really funny watching it, because I know of you all as a teacher. He was conducting and said, okay, and they all go, lo tirtzach, and all place goes, lo tirtzach. And then he waves. He made four beats. Look, he wanted to make a point. What was the point? There is no faith statement associated with lo tirtzach. There's no need for a faith statement there. Lo tirtzach should be in and of itself enough. The absence of everything that's on the right side, on the left side, is also a statement. And then lo tinaf, lo tignol, lo tarecha nechakir, lo tachmod bet riecha. And then he pointed something else out. Lo tachmod eshet riecha, look at this. V'avdo v'amato v'shoro v'chamaro v'chol ashel riecha is almost exactly parallel to the description of your house in Shabbat. I made them in blue across the side, as if this is two parts of a brit. So experientially, I mean, I'm still excited from it. This happened, let's say today's Wednesday, it happened last Sunday, a week plus ago. It was very, very powerful. But educationally, pedagogically, first of all, the first thing that happens when you bring this into a classroom is everybody's got their muskamot, how do you say it? Their kind of
conclusions,
and agreed upon premises about the Asarat HaDibrot. The first thing is, okay, let's start. Let's look at it fresh. Second thing is that once you do it this way, it's much more interactive. And then when you have people sitting there, you can suddenly see the relationship and the symmetry and the asymmetry between the two sides. And then you look at it in the context of a brit, which, by the way, what he didn't point out, and I should have added in here, is what did Moshe set up at the foot of Har Sinai? He set up a Mizbeach and 12 Matzevot to correspond with 12 Bnei Yisrael. So the whole thing is a Ma'amar HaBrit. So sitting at the core of it is these 10 statements memorialized in the Luchot, which are essentially six facing six, corresponding with the whole scheme of what Bnei Yisrael is. And you could even then move it and say that the Lechem HaPanim and the rocks and everything else then becomes sort of a reflection of the Aseret HaDibrot in the way that they're structured.
Why is it?